This is the Do the Secret Monkey podcast with Secret Monkey Weekend, and we are so pleased to have our old friend Peter Holzapfel with us from out there in the Netherlands. Where are you, Peter?
I'm not in the Netherlands. I kind of wish I was. I've got some friends over there right now, but I'm actually across town from you in delightful Durham, North Carolina, off of Coal Mill Road. You know it well.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the magic is here. You're here. We're here. Obviously, you have a new record out. Was the official date in April, mid-April, or late April?
The official date was the vinyl version was a record store day exclusive vinyl release in green glass bottle vinyl, and it was on April 12th. And then April 18th was when the CDs and the streaming were available. I mean, this is all news to me. You know, I'm been making records for years, but you do it all differently now. The staggering of releases, and you know what formats you're going to put it out on. It's kind of fascinating, but it's also, I feel terribly Luddite when you get down to it.
Yeah, same here. I'm learning a lot every week or so about something I didn't know about releasing records in this new era. I mean, it's changed a lot since 2022 when we last put our debut out.
And you a know, fine debut it was.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, Peter played on our record.
I got to play on it. I got to play in the live band for some days.
That's right. That
was fun.
He wrote a biography, which was pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm. I hope you've updated it by now.
I think we probably incorporated some elements from it there that were hard to deny that you made the world aware of.
Yeah.
You know, this conversation's probably going to go like a chat with an old friend, but we do have some questions in mind, and we'll be referring to them, whether they're on our phones or on some paper scattered through the room. But I kind of want to start with one that goes all the way to the beginning, and then we'll start working towards the album, and maybe we'll just take turns asking.
Yeah.
All right. So my first question, you moved to Winston-Salem at age 6. Is that correct?
That is correct. I did not do it alone.
You did not do it alone. You got here as fast as you could.
Well, I often wonder what life would have been like had I stayed in Old Greenwich, Connecticut, but suffice to say I didn't. And so, yeah, we came down, my dad got a new job, and we moved to Winston.
Well, my question is, what do you remember from that? I know that might be a broad question, but, you know, I remember age 1 to 6, certain things just stuck with me. How about yourself?
I have a few vignettes. I don't remember a lot because for me, life sort of started just before the Beatles. You know, I mean, I was already listening to records. I had some 45s. I would watch the Sandy Becker show on TV, and he used this Burt Camfort song, African Beat, and I loved it. And I pestered my parents at age 4 or 5 to get the 45. So that's an early memory of Old Greenwich. I remember hiding in a snowbank and freaking my mom out. She thought I disappeared. And then I felt terrible about it for decades to come.
That's wild. I think I read James Taylor did the same thing. You and James, my Lord.
Glad.
You know, but yeah, I just thought Connecticut, that would be sort of interesting. And I've looked on a map. I think I've driven right by it on my way to Hartford. Well, on the train, I wasn't driving. But,
oh, yeah. You would have. My dad took the train into work. You know, that I remember, that my dad would come home and we'd meet him at the station. In our station wagon, we were like primeval suburban family in the 60s, the early 50s. You know,
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, did your dad work in New York City?
Yes, he did. He took the train in every morning. He worked at what was called First National City Bank at the time, which is now Citibank.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All sounds right. Like you were living Mad Men. I don't know if you've ever seen Mad Men.
I've not seen it, but I've been told enough about it. And I would say that my mom would have gladly fit into the cigarette smoking, cocktail swizzling That's what she, I think she missed that when we moved to North Carolina. I think she didn't have that anymore. I think she was hoping to vault up this social strata by being with the New York banker, but
right.
She ended up liking Winston-Salem a lot.
Speaking of your mom, there was something maybe on Facebook that you were referring to, like the Roseland Ballroom had been torn down when you were on your last the last Letterman appearance with Hootie.
Yeah.
I was reading an old blog about that that you had written, or maybe even an article. And you said your mom used to go dancing there when she was a young woman.
Yes, she did. I think, I don't know how much time she actually spent in New York that wasn't with her family, but I feel certain also she made the escape periodically from her family.
It's just amazing that something like that spanned generations until it finally, you know, was no longer, I guess the real estate market changed and someone tore it down and put up a condo high rise, but that's kind of how things are going.
I'm afraid so. Yeah. It was beautiful, though. It was beautiful to look out at that. I actually played there once with Susan and Vicky, opening for the Go-Go's. The Psycho Sisters opened for the Go-Go's there, which was really cool.
Oh, man.
This is Vicky Peterson?
Yes, that's when Vicky was actually, Vicky was subbing for Charlotte Caffey in the Go-Go's. And I maybe Charlotte was having a kid or something, but she was out for a while. She may have also had a medical situation, but Vicky sat in with them and played a bunch of shows. And, you know, that's so great because it's like, there's no competition really. They just do what they do. Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about our family a little bit. I'm going to ask you one more question. I'm going to turn it over to them, but as a family man, what songs have you written in your career that were either influenced by your children or intended for your children?
Maybe none of them.
Mm.
Very possibly none of them. I will say that there is a song on the Mavericks album called "The Child in You," and it's a song that I had actually originally written for Pianosaurus, the band that I produced that uses all toy instruments.
Right.
And there is a version of it by them, but it's on the unreleased record. So that song I wrote specifically as a birth present for Hazel Rigby, who is the daughter of Will and Amy Rigby when they were a married couple. And she now is engaged to be married, and everybody is most happy about that. And she gets a little pittance every time a BMI check comes out. It goes to her mom's account.
Very sweet. Lila, would you like to chip in?
Yeah, I actually would like to start talking about your most recent album, The Face of 68. I have a question for you.
Go forth.
So you are a very prolific songwriter, and, you know, I'm sure you've written lots of songs that, you know, you haven't put out or really developed or brought to the studio. How do you decide when you have an album, what song should be on that album? Or do you sit down thinking, I'm going to write songs specifically for this album?
I know people who do the thing that you just said. Florence Dorr, our friend who makes records, she basically says, I'm going to write a record. And she's going to write, and she writes like 12 songs. And those are going to be the 12 songs on the record, which I think is kind of fascinating. I mean, I have to kind of pilfer from various sources in my hard drives. They may be something I have just written in 3 months ago, or they might be something I didn't ever release from 10 years ago. I don't really go back much further than that, but that's a good question. I mean, I don't, I knew that this was a record when I finished recording the demo of Larger Than Life. And I sat back and I listened to it, and I don't usually do this very much, but I sat back and I listened to it and I thought, hey, that's actually pretty good. It's been a while since I put a record out. I wonder if I have enough songs for a record. And so from there, I looked at what I considered candidates for the record. This is completely like ass backwards from what Florence does. I'm just like, I'm like digging in the coal mine, you know, I'm like panning for what's going to come into the sieve here. But, you know, so, but I did try to keep these songs for this record newer than the last record, Game Day, which came out in 2018. Mm-hmm. So does that sort of answer your question?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Sorry, I got to pull up my question.
Pull up your question.
Yeah. You can text it to him if you like.
We've even got a text bar in this Zoom thing that we do.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Whenever I have band meetings with somebody, I'll like, somebody will say something about, oh man, I wish I had a copy of this. And I just go to another window and pull it off of YouTube and put it in the chat.
There you go.
Because that's how we live these days.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was going to say, what do you enjoy most about working in the studio with Rob Ladd and Robert, and besides them being amazing musicians?
Robert Sledge,
yeah.
Well, here's what I liked about this situation. I sent them demos, like the stuff that I sat back and listened to. Once I got them compiled into a folder, I knew I wanted to use Rob on the record, and Rob was like, you got to use Sledge, so I sent them the demos, and I didn't have to send charts to them. Got Dixon involved, Don Dixon, our mutual producer, your producer, yes. My producer, great guy to work with. And so when we hit the door of Overdub Lane for the first session, we never rehearsed together. We hadn't played these songs together at all, but they knew the songs. They had worked on them independent of each other. They had their own notation, which I think is really handy. And the fact that they both work together in so many different occupational groups, you know, they play together in all sorts of bands and they play independent of each other. And so I got the benefit of having that kind of interlocking thought between two players that have played together for a long time and hold down the same area in a song. You know, I was very fortunate to have that. And they liked the songs. They liked the songs a lot. That made me feel good. You know, you don't want to hire a bunch of people that think, ugh,
I don't that.
How long have you been working with Don for?
Well, I've known Don since 1969, maybe. So that's what? That's a long time.
Yeah.
That's over 56
years.
Yeah. Years, something like that. But I used to go see his band play, you know, and then he, Rittenhouse Square, that band I had with Chris and Mitch when I was a teenager, we did a show that Arrogance put on, you know, the little there used to be the fire station down in Chapel Hill, down off, you know, you turn on Franklin and you would go down airport.
I guess.
And it's
fire station on the left.
There's the little split there, and there was a fire station right there. Mm-hmm. And then up the hill was where Kay Kaiser lived, from Kay Kaiser and his College of Musical Knowledge. And if you don't know him, you should look him up. Great, great North Carolinian. But we played a show with Arrogance there. And I remember that very fondly. And I remember Dixon being real excited about my teenage band. So I have done sessions for him for various records for years because he knows I'm available and I work cheap and I'm a quick study, you know, and he trusts what I come up with. He doesn't have to give me a lot of direction, but he knows if he gives me direction, I'll follow it and I'll try to get what he wants. So, but I love working with Don. He was literally the short list of producers for this record.
Okay. Well, I've got another question about the album and just the sound of it. And I'm just going to read it from my note that I made to myself. It says, not to make comparisons to your past, but DB's albums like this and Sound of Music seem to have a timeless quality where they sound like they could have been written at any point in the last 50 years. This new album has the same sonic quality to me. Did you have this in mind at all? and, you know, not to go with any trends, you know, like I want to make an album that pleases me and therefore it will be timeless. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's the artist's prerogative to determine what is going to be timeless. I mean, I don't think Billy Joel sat back and when he listened to Just the Way You Are, thought, hey, I've got a stone classic here. People are going to be singing this at weddings for the end of time.
Yeah.
You know, they don't think that. You know, you can't really think that. You know, you don't know what your place in the mm-hmm. big fabric of music is going to be. So I think really what happened with this record was going back to that fateful listening to Larger Than Life and thinking, this is a really good song, and it's kind of heavy guitar, actually, when you get right down to it. It doesn't have that kind of twinkly pop stuff that, you know, is going to follow me to my grave. It's got some grit to it, and maybe some of these other songs. And so I started listening, and I found Anytime Soon, which I realized was also, that was a B-list song at first. But now I really love it starting the record, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think really what I tried to do was aim for songs that were harder edged guitar songs, you know? I mean, I didn't want it to sound like the Drifters. I didn't want it to sound like the DBs. I didn't want it to sound like anything I'd done. That much I knew. And I felt that by doing it like in 3.5 days with a producer and with Sledge and Rob, that I would only be able to make a certain kind of record. You know, if you don't sit there sweating over overdubs and putting, you know, Welsh male voice choirs and gamelans on songs, you know, you can actually come up with something that sounds energetic and fresh and like the players were interested at the time of the recording.
Yeah.
I always go back to the the outtake from Abbey Road, where the engineer comes on and says, something, take 45. And the song starts, and it's never sounded slower. It really has never, ever sounded slower. So yeah. I believe in the surprise factor of being able to, you know, put it down fast before you, you know, sat in there. We didn't rehearse the song, so we sat in there in the big room, all sitting together, and we would play it one time, and Sledge and Rob would talk, and they would have their little, you know, cone of silence between the rhythm section, as your rhythm section knows, you know, sometimes you have to kind of not talk to the guitar player, but just talk amongst yourselves to get the part.
Yeah.
So that's what they would do. And I would just sit there kind of twiddling my thumbs, and eventually I'd go into the other room, and then we cut a track and we do two or three takes of it. And Dixon would be like, well, I think the second take was probably the best. So that's what we went for. And having him in there and having Jason Richmond as our engineer, who I'd worked with in there on Paranoid style stuff, it was like a great team. All I had to do was go out there and be the rock star.
Yeah. So were any first takes the best take?
Lord, I don't know. Probably. I just, you know, the whole thing, it was like a tornado of events, you know, and we worked regular, like normal banker's hours in the studio. It wasn't like we were working really late. No. I mean, Dixon stayed probably an hour after just to listen to stuff and maybe clean some stuff up. But, you know, we were really accurate when we put the stuff down. So right. That was kind of working on our side as well.
In terms of producing and mastering, other than Don, did you have a hand in kind of like, sorry, I lost my train of thought for a minute.
Mixing
at all?
No, actually, well, yeah, maybe sort of. Dixon took the stuff that we did. We did all the recording of vocals and all the overdubs pretty much in 3.5 days, and then spent a half a day putting the stuff back that was out of order, you know, in the studio. A good guest cleans up afterward, right? And so Dixon took the stuff to his studio, and just every few days I would get a mix or two. And I was like, this is working fine. And I would send him back notes if I felt like something had to be different. We cut we did cut a version of the title track, but I liked the demo better. And so we went back and forth about the, like, the level of the drums on that. And I ended up kind of prevailing. I mean, I trust Don's ears. I think Don knows how to mix a record better than I do. I think I proved that on game day. I don't know how to mix a record. I can write a song, maybe not mix a record. It's okay. There's people that do that professionally. Yeah. And then I had, for the vinyl edition of the record, Jeff Powell at Take That Vinyl in Memphis did the mastering, and he's superb. He's done a lot of stuff for me in the past. So I was glad to have another part of the team.
So did you use some of the studio amps, or did you bring your Pro Junior in there?
I think I used, they had a Princeton in there, and they had a Car Rambler, and we used the Trek 2 pedal that puts the guitar into the Leslie cabinet, and you can, you know, get the speed going on that. I may have brought the Pro Junior, but I don't think I used it. I think I just fluctuated between the Car and the Princeton. Maybe there's a Deluxe in there too.
Okay.
And then Sledge used the House B15 Ampeg, and Rob brought his drums.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How about guitars? Did you favor one over any others?
What did I use most? Well, I used my Esquire, my Telecaster Esquire, the blue thing that I've had for forever with the maple neck. I used that. I got the Les Paul Standard out because I felt like I deserved to play it, and I'd played it on the last Paranoid Style, and it sounded really great, and it didn't sound like the Telecaster. So I had those. I used the Epiphone ES-339, that little small-bodied, thin-bodied, thin-line electric. Okay. Because that's where I was able to do, like, coil tap and have a single coil and a humbucking, which was
right.
Cool. So that was pretty much it. I used the Silvertone acoustic for One for the Book, which is the only song on the record that has an acoustic guitar on it for once in my life.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, so to me, the standout track was High, High Horse. I was going to ask, could you tell me about the creation of that song a little bit?
Sure. That's, you know what? I'm glad to hear you say that, Ella, because that's one of the kind of sleeper tracks, if you will. You know, there's some stuff that goes out there on that record that I think just is sort of like having the baseball bat going across your skull, which is what I wanted, of course. But,
yeah.
But I had other songs, and I wanted to get them on there too. And I felt like High, High Horse fit. And I did a demo of that a few years ago, and I kept going back to it. You know, it was one of those things where I wasn't sure what to do with it. I wrote it, you know. The sheer creation of it sort of had to be enough at that point. But then when I started listening to it and thinking about it, I kind of liked what the lyrics were talking about. And it's a, you know, there's a fair amount of looking back going on my part in the lyrics of this record. I mean, you're 69 years old. There's a lot still to look forward to, but there's a lot of what's gone on that you think about and wonder how things might have been different, or if you'd done them the right way. You know, I've been consumed with the fact that I think now, as the Monday morning quarterback, lo, these decades later, that I should have just chucked college, gone straight to New York when I was 18 years old, and that would have been, what, 1974? I think. And that's like the Dolls are going on, and, you know, these other bands are getting started. And it's like, I don't know, but maybe not. Who knows? So you second guess yourself. And I think High, High Horse, there's a certain amount of second guessing going on. You know, if I tried a little harder, planned a little better, I mean, that sort of stuff. You only can do what you can do, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
I hope.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can't get stuck on, like, how would certain scenarios go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Got a question.
You can, but it's like treading water, you know?
Yeah. It's not good for your brain.
was going to bounce down to Lila to see if you had a question. Anything you guys want to follow up on?
I think I ran out of questions.
You don't want to ask me what gauge picks do you use, Peter?
Okay. This is another one I wrote out.
Okay.
I think your guitar playing is inventive and unique. You know, I don't think, you know, when I hear your guitar, I don't know, I could probably pick you out. You know, wow. I think you're rather unique. And you tend to play clean to my ears, but this record, you got a little dirtier with the sound. But when you were in the studio, with that said, did you feel like you wanted to channel a feel or a certain player or influence while you were with the cans on and recording?
Well, not necessarily. When I had done the Paranoid Style record earlier that year, or the previous year with Jason Engineering in the studio, Elizabeth Nelson had said, "We want the guitars to sound like Eliminator by ZZ Top." And Jason was like, "Okay, got it." And he nailed it. So when I walked in again, this time as in the guise of being my only guitar player, he knew stylistically how I played. So that was really handy. And so I think that while I may not have come in with solos written, I did feel enough confidence in my lead guitar playing to kind of jump off that cliff and flap madly and hope that I remain aloft and have a soft landing, you know? I mean, I've learned over the years how to play a lead guitar part effectively. I think I'm much better at it now than I used to be. And that's simply because I have had so many great guitar players coming through the bands that I played in: Mitch, Chris, Gene, Robert Mache, Gary Eaton, Ray Ganeshow. Oh my God, Sam Fraser now, you know? I mean, what's he doing slumming with me live? I mean, he doesn't need to be doing this, but he likes the music and that's cool. So I feel that gives me confidence too, that he doesn't mind stepping back and just being in a kind of a support position. Because I've been that guy. I'm a good rhythm guitar player, and I know I can do that. Me and Will locked at the snare arm, you know? Yeah. But I needed to step fully into the lead guitar thing. And I had done that with the combo, with Will and with Glenn Jones. And I was starting to feel how to do it. But then the wind went out of my sails and I needed to do something else. So I did. And I'm glad that I got to play with those guys, because they helped me obviously get some of these songs, like That Kind of Guy, into fighting shape to make this record. So, but yeah, I mean, I appreciate you saying that about my guitar playing, because I thought you were going to say it's unique. It's not very good, but it's unique, you know. And it's like, but I mean, that's how I sort of approach it. I'm like, except I don't anymore, because I'm now old enough and wise enough to know that I actually am pretty good. I can hear myself play, and I'm really proud of that achievement. And you know, I'm going up to DC with Paranoid Style in a couple of weeks to play a show with them, and I get to show off on those songs for people. I love it. You know, it's really great. It's a whole different mindset when you're out there as the lead guitar picker, you know, especially if you got a whole band behind you, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned maybe on social media that the next slate of gigs you're playing to support the album going further west and so forth will be solo. Is that correct?
I think so, yeah. I've got a couple of shows scheduled out west. I've got one show with a rhythm section and another guitar player, and I wanted to see how the shows last week went before I decided for sure to you know, follow through with the LA show being a band show. But these guys are pros. Two of them are part of the Wild Honey Orchestra. It's Nick Vincent and David Nolte, both longtime music veterans out there, and a guy named Jeff Perlman on guitar, who I got recommended, and he and I seem to be on the same wavelength, and he also is very, very good and very cool about, like, letting me be, you know, Tarzan of the guitar, you know, if I need to. Of course, it's a backyard show, and it's going to be little tiny amps, so it's going to be like, Tarzan!
I did have a question. I just thought of this based on the way you talked about music. So do you write out everything you do, like, in music notation, or do you have a different system of notation, or do you just memorize everything you play?
I do these for your band too, but let me see if I've got something sitting around here. Ordinarily, it's just like, I'll show you what it looks like. This has served me well, because I can't read music. Mm-hmm. So I'll do it one of two different ways. I'll do it like this. Can you see?
Yeah.
Okay. So that just counts out the beats and the bars and the chords. Mm-hmm. Or if there's some kind of indeterminate aspect of what the key is going to be, I'll do something like this, and I'll have...
Oh, it's blurred.
Pull back a bit.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. So yeah. It's Roman numerals, and I use lowercase Roman numerals for minors, minor chords. I can't read music. I tried. I even was a music major when I was a freshman at Carolina, but then I realized I probably shouldn't be in there because I couldn't read music, and everybody else could, and everybody else had been taking piano lessons since they were born. I'm a folk singer. I got an acoustic guitar. Like, I don't know. You know, I can tell you the Beatle chords, but I can't tell you, you know, I can't. I would, like, fail writing assignments like Bach fugues and stuff like that, or, like, you know, because I would do, like, perfect fourths moving. You can't do that. Perfect fifths, perfect fourths. You don't move parallels like that. So I have a lot to learn.
Yeah, as someone who used to be able to read music and I can't anymore, to me, it's like a language. You have to practice it constantly.
Yes.
Like, when I was 10, I could sight read and play. Now, if you put that in front of me, I'm like, I don't know what this says.
Well, I feel like it's a bicycle that you can get back on, though. I feel like if you sat down with your bass and you had, like, a chart of a song, you know, you would be able to knock through that easily enough. I mean, the notes haven't moved.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of small questions and then we'll let you go. But, okay, this is very, very way back, but who played lead guitar on Love Is for Lovers?
Gene Holder.
Okay.
Gene Holder took the better part of an afternoon to get that guitar solo, including the explosion at the beginning was the EMT plate is the, maybe it was a thing that looked like R2-D2, but it was in the studio at Bearsville. And it was like this reverb, like an early, like, fake reverb tank. And you could, like, you had controls on the outside. Yeah. And we just, like, dialed that in. It was really, really great. And he just, you know, wait, Love Is for Lovers?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's me. I'm sorry. I'm lying.
That's you.
I thought you, you know what I was telling the story of is New Gun in Town.
Okay.
New Gun in Town is Gene. That is Gene his best. Yeah, I mean, Love Is for Lovers. Yeah, it's me playing lead on that. There's some the high stuff at the end, I think, maybe Gene.
Okay, that might be the stuff I'm thinking about. Seems like after the second chorus, there is some lead guitar, and it's almost like pinched notes. It's way up there. And for the life of me, it sounds like whoever is playing that could just go and play for Blue Oyster Cult, and the other guy can just, you know, nap for 3 weeks because it just had this.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I'd have to listen to it again. I can't think what it is, but just trying to think back on the, like, us playing it live last year.
Yeah.
And Chris and I would do a kind of an interlocking part where one note bends and the other doesn't, you know, sort of that sort of phony Richard Thompson, semi-bendy guitar parts. But, you know, because it's Richard Thompson, it takes two mere mortals to play like him.
One of these days, if I'm at your house or you're at mine, I will sit down and give you the one little piece that I don't know, it makes my hair stand up. It's just so good. But it also sounds like, I love it if someone does sort of make an allusion to another musician or passage. You know, jazz guys do it all the time. To me, that part just sounds like that, and it just makes me, my arms tingle every time I hear it. It's just a fine track, and the guitars just blow me away on that
song. Well, we were so excited when we mixed that song, and we sat around that control room at Bearsville, and we were all patting each other on the back and saying how good this was going to be, and it's going to be our grandchildren's retirement fund and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And you just cannot count on those things, you know. You can want it as much as you want it. You know, the best thing that we got out of it was a really good record. And it's the record I can listen to this day. I'm still exceptionally proud of what the DBs did. You know, I mean, we'd lost Chris and everybody was looking at me and I was like, everybody's looking at me. Why are you looking at me? I just write songs. I don't know what you're doing this for. And it was like, actually, you need to write a bunch of songs and make a record. So we felt like that was the thing to do. And I was grateful to have Will and Gene following along with me. I dragged them through the mud for years.
You passed the audition for sure.
I guess so. I hope so.
Okay. My final question before we let you go. When you first announced that the album was going to be called Face of 68, the first thought I had was, oh, that's a reference to Peter Frampton when he was in The Herd and New Music Express or something called him the Face of 68 because he was this really good-looking young guy. And I think I followed the thread when you posted that. Nobody said anything, so I thought I'd write you privately. And you said, yes, that is indeed a reference. But it wasn't until I heard the record that I realized, maybe the last person to realize, that it was possibly about your age at the time of the recording.
All these things and more, Jeff, I promise.
Well, I thought it would be
to all people. You know, you try to write a song.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get off this phone call and say, maybe I've written a classic. Who knows?
Well, I thought I was being clever, and then I realized, you know, I might have been quite dumb.
I think you should have your interpretation.
Okay. Well, anyway. I think
absolutely. You know, both of those are exactly what it was. I mean, the Face of 68 obviously is the reference to Peter Frampton. And we did actually try to get in touch with Peter Frampton to see if he might be available to fly a part in of that little guitar solo after the middle, after another famous explosion in a lead guitar solo. And so we got in touch. Dixon was like, yeah, you should do that, definitely. What's the worst they can say? No, you know. And like, okay. So I wrote, and somehow or other, I can't remember how I got his address or his management's address, and I wrote and I said, my name is Peter Holzapfel, blah 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 blah, I'm doing a record and it's called Face of 68. It'd be, you know, really funny and ironic and hilarious, and, you know, for the 10 people that are going to get this, if Peter Frampton played 10 seconds of guitar solo on this. And they all they wrote back was, we know who you are. And I was like, okay,
what did you do?
I was like, you know, I my solo will stand, I think it's fine, I get it, you know, busy, he's, you know, and I and to his credit, he is a very busy guy, he's been touring, you know, he's got some health issues. He's got some physical ailments where he has to sit down and play at this point, I think. And he's going to probably have to stop playing at some point, which is a drag. I can't imagine what that's like, you know. But we thought of him anyway, and we love him. And, you know, it would have been nice, but I think my solo works just fine.
Well, it's a marvelous record, and it's just, you know, like I said, it's just very pleasing to my ears. And I do think, you know, you didn't go for any faddish sounds. You went in and just made sounds that were true to yourself, and you had a marvelous crew with you on it. And then the live shows, you know, the tone of Sam Fraser is unmatched. The guy, for years, that's all I've thought about is how he gets such a great tone. I've, you know, looked behind the curtain and looked at his amp or his pedal board. And anyway, long story short, marvelous album, marvelous presentation live. And I guess basically, what's the best way people can find this album and find you if they want to follow you and listen to your music?
Well, they'll have to hunt me down to follow me now. I like to leave about 3 car lengths between the people behind me where possible. I'm a fairly active guy on Facebook. I've got a Peter Holzapfel, the face of fifth. Look at that. I'm taking 10 years off of the damn record. The face of 68. It's a page for that, and it'll have all the dates and stuff of shows as I get them. I've got a blog called Does This Band Make Me Look Fat? I'm an infrequent blogger because I'm terrible. I have no self-discipline. Tut, tut, tut. I'm on Blue Sky sometimes. I'm on Instagram sometimes. I just want to play in your town, wherever you may be. If you hear this, just find me and I'll come play for you. And I'm really quite good live.
Hear, hear.
My friends here will tell you that no brag, just fact, right?
Just fact. If it's true, you're not bragging. So
yeah,
that's what I think.
Dizzy Dean said that, and you know, we'll live by that. So perfect. But Peter, it's been our marvelous pleasure to have you. It's always a fun time to chat with you wherever it is, our front steps, in our house, at gigs. It's just great catching up with you, and to do it this way and share with other people, it's even, you know, it's just another thing that we're really glad we know you. We're happy to share your music and what you do. So
thank you all so much. We do go way back, four of us, a long way, and all of our families and stuff. And I'm grateful to have you all in my life as well. You've enriched my worldview considerably.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Peter, with that said, wishing you well on your tour this summer and beyond, and we'll catch you wherever we can find you.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks so much.
See you soon.
The secret monkey.